that with a response.
Not at all. No, guys, but it's good to see you again. I think it was about maybe a month or two ago I was in your podcast, the Changelog, and now the tables have turned, and you can do kind of a reverse podcast.
Thanks
so
for having us.
Anytime. Yeah. Yeah, it's so much fun on your podcast. I think we went for a long, long time, and it's like, I like talking to these guys. Let's do a podcast. I guess this is what podcast hosts do. We have no rhyme or reason. We just, right. I guess our phone calls end up just being podcasts with each other.
Just always be recording. That's what we say. Just let's hit record.
That's right.
And then start talking and see what happens.
That's awesome. How you guys been since we last chatted?
Doing well. Doing well. How you doing, Adam?
I think I'm doing pretty good. I feel good. I'm looking slightly better than last time.
You look good.
Just slightly better.
Yeah.
I've been trying to manage, you know, my appearance. I brushed my teeth today twice.
Whoa. Oh,
yeah, I mean, just got to make sure they're super clean. And, you know, I flossed even. It was amazing.
That's crazy.
Do you floss, though?
Okay, I'm the weird dude. I will floss like 5-6 times a day.
No. Are you being serious?
I'm dead serious.
Are you really?
It's probably not good for your gums, but okay.
It probably isn't, but I'm just the weirdo. I'm like, there's like some, if it's like, there's something in my tooth. I know there is. So I have to go floss. I'm like, why not just go all of them while you're at it? Right. So yeah, I'm probably not healthy at all.
I'm told the opposite. I don't floss. And it's only so that when I go to the dentist and she says, when's the last time you flossed? I can say, when's the last time I was here? Like the entire reason I don't floss is just for that joke. Just for that opportunity. And she always rolls her eyes and I say, yeah, twice a year.
So this is the All Things Dentistry show. So we're going to talk about our dental habits the whole time. I do think it is interesting though, because I have some friends who are dental hygienists, and like you should floss at least once a week, but she sees like the craziest stuff in people's teeth, like popcorn from like a while ago, weird stuff. Yeah, it's like.
I think eventually you start to taste that or smell it or something, but we should probably change the subject.
I don't know, man. It's interesting. There. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so we have one obsessive toothbrusher, one obsessive flosser, and one guy who only does it when he's at his appointments. Awesome. Anyways, what else is on your mind these days besides looking good and hygiene?
Man, what is on my mind these days? I just feel like AI is everywhere. You know, the last time we talked, did we mean to talk about AI, Jared, or did that just come up? Like that was
we're talking
conversation.
About data. I mean, Joe's a data guy, so
right. So
that kind of leads naturally into, you know, learning on data and training on data and all the things. But we don't ever plan to talk about it, and yet we always end up talking about it. It's just that time of the year. Or the time of the decade. I don't know what's going on.
It is the time of the decade, I think. It's the inevitable conversation. Let me ask you this. Do you ever find yourself talking about AI outside of your podcast? Maybe just with random people?
Like non-tech folks?
Non-tech folks, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're mostly like still oblivious. They're aware that ChatGPT exists, but they don't use it. And even folks who do use it, they're like, I don't get it. And there's some people who are like non-technical, totally get it, and they're writing books with it kind of folks, you know, that they're like using it to like help them outline and write the general parts of it. And they obviously go back and fine tune and stuff like that. But
interesting. Yeah,
I don't think that people are really leveraging AI to the degree. Well, children are. When I say children, I mean like younger than, I don't know, me, I suppose, like 20. Folks
everyone
in school
use a child,
right? My son does not use it. He doesn't have access, right? Like he's a kid. He's 8. He barely has access to his Switch, and that's only on privilege, you know. And he's a kid, so I think the younger folks who are in like college and whatnot are doing a lot of stuff with it. I mean, that's kind of obvious. Those young folks are early adopters on those things.
My kids definitely use their Echoes a lot. Like they talk to Alexa constantly. And I talk to Siri some, but I'm waiting for like, when are those two going to get their upgrades? You know, when are they going to become good?
Yeah, it's going to change. Yeah.
If you just put ChatGPT's brain inside of Siri, like Siri is like 10x better than it is right now. And Alexa's got some knowledge, and facts and stuff, but it's super slow, hard to talk to, just not real smart. And I feel like it's an easy win to just plug in the new back end of those suckers, and immediately they're just so much more valuable. So they're using those. They talk to them like it's a person, you know, because they're kind of growing up alongside having an Alexa.
I'll give you that. My kids are the same, Jared. Both my sons have talked to Siri as if Siri is real. You know, like when you're young and like three or four, like he's four now, but when he was three, he did this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
My son, he would talk to Siri as if like it was a real person, like having a conversation and like just going deep. But I agree. That's definitely worth talking about is whenever the voice assisted version of AI can be what Siri could be and what Alexa tries to be.
Yeah.
Because I definitely do a lot of math with Siri. Like I'm a coffee guy. My wife laughs at me because every day I will weigh out my beans. Sometimes it's 20 grams. Sometimes it's 18 grams. Sometimes it's 22.5 grams. And the ratio I go with is like a 1 to 16 or a 1 to 17. And so I say, hey, Siri, 22.5 times 17.
22.5 times 17 is 382.5.
And so then I pour 382 grams of water through my filter. That's the extent of me using Siri on the daily, his right. versions of that math.
That's insane. I don't think I've ever met anyone who is that meticulous about their coffee.
It is insane, isn't it?
So,
well, I'm a meticulous guy. I have to be, you know?
Well, yeah, you brush your teeth like twice a day. I know.
At least twice a day.
Yes, that's crazy. Well, I guess it kind of if you extend that notion to appliances and stuff, like why aren't they when you make a cup of coffee, you know, why doesn't it just like ask what your preferences are and just make sure you're not going over or under? I guess the kind of world I always envisioned was that appliances would be more like assistants, where it's kind of like having a butler,
yeah,
sort of. And right now, Siri just feels, or in Alexa too, it just feels like I have something that talks back at me with things, and I still have to do everything. And being incredibly lazy, it would be great if it could just do everything for you. So
yeah, the place that we've gotten with appliances, I think, is a bad place where they're all now internet connected and require more smarts and software and apps than they did before.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really gained much from that besides
no.
Your washing machine will notify you when it's right. done. But also, you know, an old school washing machine stops making noise when it's finished. And so that also notifies you. I'm kind of ready to go back to just like hard old school mechanical things that don't have planned obsolescence built into them that like last a long time and work well. So, but I do agree with you that it'd be nice if like, if they are going to be internet connected and quote unquote smart, they should at least be awesome. You know, like where's that future that we've been told was coming? I don't know.
I'm of two sides to that one. I agree with you on the what have we gained aspect. Because I think the smartest thing I have in my house appliance-wise is my washer and dryer. It's an LG. They're both LGs. They're a pair. And I only recently, like this thing has been Wi-Fi capable for years. And I was like, I should like use that feature. Like this is like months ago and I've owned them for like 4 years, right? And so what I gained from it, basically, you can't turn it on if it's off via the app. So if the thing is not on, you have to physically go to it to turn it on to work with it. And that's probably a safety feature, right? I'm cool with that.
Mm-hmm.
If that's why. But then I think the best thing you could do is like just configure how you wash your clothes with it, but then you could just do the same thing on exactly. the screen. So like, why would I not be present at the washer or the dryer to do the configuration? I don't need the application for it. And then like you had said, Jared, I'm kind of reiterating elusively in a lot of details here is that it just notifies me when my dryer is done. And like, even when it notifies me, I kind of don't care. Because it's probably not even me doing it, but it's still telling me because I'm getting the notification.
Right.
You know, the notification is going to everybody who has the app, not the one who pushed the button because it's not that smart. And I think you might have Nespressos and things like that. Those are not very smart. That's just a push button thing. what else is smart in your house? That's appliances. Like my oven. I would love my oven to be smarter. That'd be kind of cool.
Ovens are cool, but then I have a smart oven, and it just tells me when the temperature, when they, like, the oven's like preheated. Then it's like, yeah. Awesome, thank you. I'm kind of obsessive compulsive about certain things. Like when I leave the house, is the oven off? Right.
That's true.
So before it, I always drive back and check. Then I'm that guy. I maybe I'll drive back twice just to double check. Just the double case. Checking of it.
Are you serious?
I might. Yeah.
I got a floss while I'm here too.
Yeah, you should floss.
Yeah,
you gotta floss.
Check your oven, floss.
You gotta floss. The app is like, I can just check it. I'm on the road. I'm like, okay, the house isn't gonna be on fire. It's great. But I'm kind of weird though, because for my dryer at home, I actually like a dumb one in my washer and dryer set, because I actually do my own repairs on them. So just.
That's smart.
They're not that hard. I mean, like, once in a while your timer goes out and you just, like, it costs you like $40 to get a new part off of Amazon. It takes you like 5 minutes to replace it. It's not that hard. So
this is skewing a little bit into the right to repair stuff. I talked to the CEO of iFixit about recently. His name's Kyle.
Oh, no way.
It's on the podcast.
Not that his name's Kyle, but that you talked to the iFixit guy.
Kyle.
Wow.
Yeah, his name is Kyle Weens, and he's I would kind of, in a way, call him an accidental founder of iFixit, because he was trying to, I'm going to paraphrase a version of his story, he was trying to fix an old, like, MacBook. I believe it was an old MacBook. And Apple used copyright law to disallow the repair guide from being published on the internet. And so they used DMCA law essentially for this. And this is years ago. And so iFixit began, and still is, a wiki mainly, but they also have tooling and stuff like that, and they're activists around rights to repair and whatnot. And he published the first guide. So he was like, I'm going to buy this thing and take it apart and take pictures of it. And he published the first iFixit guide on how to, you know, tear down and fix this MacBook Pro or MacBook or whatever it was at the time. And that's how iFixit began. Now he's like a activist around this thing. And you mentioned, Jared, of like planned obsolescence. It's totally true. Like, I'm concerned with, like, if we add too much smarts to it, how does that, like, they just become computers, basically. Like, your car's bad enough. John Deere's bad enough that farmers can't fix their stuff. That's a pretty well-known, very analog, one of the oldest tools in American history, farming, tractors. Uh-huh. And now it's basically a big computer. At the same time, you know, I would love to at least have, like, the on-off button smarts in pretty much everything. Like you said, Joe, like, my garage is my oven for you. So my garage, I'm like, are my garage doors closed? I've got to go.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And now my neighbor was like, hey, because we've had this, we're in the neighborhood, and same builder did my house and same builder did his house. And he's like, I had no idea, Adam, but my... our garage is like, do you have this one? And I'm like, yes, I have that one. He's like, well, did you know it's Wi-Fi enabled by default? I'm like, I had no idea. He's like, and the app is free. And I said, and the app is free. And we were excited. And so I went home that day and checked it out. And sure enough, it was. And so now I have Wi-Fi on off buttons. I could tell right now if my garage is closed. And I know when it gets opened and I know when it gets closed. And I know who did it, because you have users in the system, basically. And it's free. And I think that's super cool. Like, the on-off button smarts, that to me is, I would value that in every appliance. Well, ovens, not my washer and dryer, definitely my garage doors, are they closed or not? TVs, I don't know. I kind of wish that, like, TVs would just, like, auto off at some point. I go upstairs and find my family room TV on. I'm like, why is this TV on? And I've got the energy setting on it, and it's just not listening to me. Come on.
I hate it when my TV is not listening to me. That's, you know, sarcasm. I don't want my TV to listen to me.
Well, does it have Siri?
Yeah, exactly. Is that Siri, Adam?
No. Well, it's a Sony TV, so it's like a dumb TV, basically. Actually, I think it's a smart TV. I don't use the smarts in it. And I have an Apple TV attached to it. And so I can say, I don't think I could do it from here. I think I have to be in the house. I'll just say family room off to Siri, and she turns it off.
That's the closest. It would be super annoying. You could do what Netflix does. Like, are you still watching?
Oh, yeah.
You know they're just trying to save themselves some bandwidth there. They're just They're just, we're going to pause this and make sure you're still watching. We're going to stop streaming this because it's been going for a while. Like, yeah, I'm still watching.
It's an interesting point, though, about the right to repair stuff and having, I guess, kind of the dichotomy of old school and new school technologies in your house, right? Like, I had a choice last year of getting a Tesla or I have a cabin in Wyoming I go to, right? So it's like, okay, first of all, Teslas may not get there. And if the charging station's not working, you're very, very screwed. So that kind of, and then I thought, okay, so also I'm basically getting, I feel like electric cars are still like basically buying a PC back in like 1985 or something. It just feels like that's the state of technology. And so I ended up getting the exact opposite. I got a gas guzzling Toyota 4Runner 2018 off-road edition that gets like 14 miles to gallon. But I can also fix a lot of that stuff if I needed to, right? Not maybe not all of it, but most of it. So still pretty handy with a mechanics and stuff like that. So that's, that was the rationale. It was like, I just felt like I'm buying just basically a giant paperweight of a computer that in about 5-10 years is going to be a paperweight of a computer. And who knows what I do with that.
I suppose. I never really thought about the longevity of electric cars until you said that, really. I mean, I just didn't consider what it takes to repair them, even. I don't even know what's in them.
I can probably imagine how the wheels work
and the brakes work, because they're probably standard like a normal car, right? Rotor brakes, disc brakes.
Yeah, but I mean, everything else is different. I mean, the battery is the deal. The battery is the deal. And in fact, the real bummer about Teslas is that many years ago, Elon Musk promised and even demoed, quote unquote, demoed on stage a Tesla that could pull up to a battery station and have its battery swapped underneath it, like the bottom opens up and you swap in a new battery and go. And it was amazing. Like, how amazing would that be? Because the problem is, yeah, you're waiting for it to charge. You're also, that battery goes bad over time. We also see them start fire when they get into accidents. But I mean, batteries are very combustible, so it's hard to fix that problem. But the battery is the problem, I think. It's like, it's great for a while, and then, yeah, 5-10 years, the battery goes bad, and if you can't swap that battery out, then you're basically in really trouble. Now, it would have been really cool if they would have delivered on that future of, I pull up into a battery station, and in the matter of 30 seconds, it's like a pit stop, you know, where they're switching your tires out. You're just, you know, dead battery goes out, new battery comes in, and that one stays there, and they charge that one up for the next person or whatever, and you're off to the races. That would have been really cool, and it just never happened. I don't know why.
You know, the charging's actually interesting, because a friend of mine one day picked me up when I was in Munich this time last year, and we went on a trip through Austria and the Alps in his Tesla. And on the Autobahn, which, by the way, if you ever get a chance to take a Tesla on the Autobahn, please do. It is amazing. Is that right? Yeah, it's so much fun. It goes really fast. But the whole thing was, we have to keep stopping over and over and over again to get charged. Like, supercharge stations here, another hour there. And I'm like, okay, it's fun. But and they have them at Burger King's, which is nice. So you can just get, you know, morbidly obese, like making these stops. so that's pretty awesome. But yeah, it's like, it seems like a lot of hassle, right? Like it's cool, but it was also like, we're having to stop every hour basically to keep,
how long does the charge take?
Oh, we're probably there for a good 10-15 minutes each time.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. And granted, we're gunning it too. Like, you know, you're on the Autobahn, like you're, but still, it's like, okay, this is interesting. But yeah, you're absolutely right too. It's like the batteries, that, and then, you know, I had some friends who had like was it Leafs, like Nissan Leafs or whatever it was. I think they go like, they have a range like 50 miles or something like that. And those are, I think once the battery died, like my friend just had to go have it recycled or something, because the resale value of it, it's like you couldn't really give it away even. It's gonna be too much money. So
the hybrids are making a comeback. I saw recently that hybrid sales are up quite a bit, while EVs kind of plateau and maybe even start to revert a little bit. And it seems like, I always thought a hybrid was the worst of both worlds. You know, you have to have both engine types, so to speak, in there. I don't know exactly how they work, but it seems like what I like about the electric car is just the simplicity of the internals. I don't like oil changes. I don't like the way combustion engines work. It's all very complicated. It's scary to me. You open up one of these things, they're very simple machines, and in comparison. And for a hybrid, it's like, well, do I have to support both styles inside the car? That seems twice as complicated as one or the other. But they must have a nice balance that they've struck, because you get great gas mileage and they're selling like hotcakes at this point. So maybe the people are like attracted by the gas mileage of, quote unquote, gas mileage of an electric car. But all of the drawbacks, like you're talking about, Joe, they just are not feasible for so many use cases that it's like, I just don't want to pigeonhole myself into all electric. And so it seems like people are buying hybrids right now.
Well, you live in it looks like you live in kind of a rural area there, Jared. I mean, I'm looking behind you and there's like farmland.
Yep.
I grew up outside of there, actually, in Omaha. But it's like, it's there's a lot of driving you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
In
it's
20 area.
Minutes everywhere, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, so. But nothing is more than 40 minutes. I mean, I can get to Lincoln 45. And so right. I've been very attracted to a Tesla. I don't have one. But
just that would make sense there.
In the city there, it makes tons of sense. I'm at home every night, so I don't have to like look for supercharger stations. It's always going to be charged up. And anywhere I go is 20 to 40 minutes. I'm not going to take it anywhere else. But then you're like, well, if I'm going to buy a car, I might want to drive to Chicago, or I might want to drive to Denver or down to Houston or Austin to see Adam. And now I'm doing what you were doing, where it's like, I got to make a plan to like make 17 stops on the way, which is just not cool.
Not cool at all. I got some data here on batteries for Teslas.
Oh, yeah.
I just did some Googling while we're talking here. Recurrentaudio.com is the website. There's a research page there on Tesla battery replacement costs. And they do say they can be replaced. They say that third-party shops are becoming more popular because you can take your vehicle, obviously, to Tesla to get repaired. Mm-hmm. And that's the most common option, is the Tesla service center. And if it's under warranty, they'll obviously take care of it. But the costs for these things, like an all-in cost, end-to-end, like battery replaced, not just the cost of the battery, but the whole total cost of the replacement, is for the Model S, which is pretty common, $20,000 to $22,000.
Wow.
The Model 3, which is also quite common, I see those a lot around here in Austin and Dripping Springs area, is around 16,000, basically, rounding up. The Model Y does not have data listed here, but it says it's probably going to be around $15,000 to replace the Model Y. So, I mean, like, that's pretty expensive.
Well, that's like a whole other car you could have bought.
Yeah. I mean, that's the life of the car, usually. They say 5 to 10 years is the rough range for a lot of the replacement needs. J.D. Power said that. Others said that it would be around 10.
Interesting.
They can be replaced, and it's usually around 10 to 20 years. Maybe sooner. And it depends on like how often you use it. And then the other challenge is like fade or discharge. So your battery can fade, meaning it takes longer to charge it.
Sure.
And then discharge means it takes longer to discharge energy, which means the car feels sluggish. So there's other like things you'll experience while the battery may not die and need to be fully replaced. You'll have a degraded driving experience.
The 20-year number is interesting, because I wonder what they base it on, if that's just the expected life, because like electric cars really haven't been around since 2004. So
that's true. Yeah,
that's fascinating. My brother-in-law, he just got a Cybertruck recently. As a side note, if you want something that looks really goofy, is awesome, you should get that one.
Doesn't your neighbor have one, Adam?
Yeah, my neighbor has one as well.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Pre-ordered it 4 years ago, finally got it. I mean, they're not really that expensive. That's the funny thing about them, is that they're rare, because they just got released, obviously.
Yeah.
They're rare, but they're not like, oh, that person's driving like a Maserati or something like that, which is like, you know, a 200 grand car kind of thing. It's like sub $100,000 in most cases. Like there's different flavors of it, but like sub $100,000. Like, my truck costs almost that much.
Mm-hmm.
An F-250.
Oh, that's a nice truck.
Yeah.
It's a nice truck.
Trucks are expensive, man.
Trucks are expensive as hell. Well, check this out, though. So, I guess there's my brother-in-law is telling me there's a black market for Cybertrucks. So, they're going in for like $250,000 right now, if you're a resell. But your contract with Tesla says you can't resell for a year. So you're seeing these like these dodgy deals, or somebody's like, "Hey, you know, I just need to transfer the name on my profile to yours, and then like it'll totally work. You just give me a quarter mil, it's fine."
Seems a little risky.
Oh wow! I mean, you could also rent it to them for a year. Mm. You know, you're it could be like a 1 year lease to purchase at end of year one. I mean, you can get non-dodgy on it. That is interesting, though. I mean, I know somebody who is wealthy, and they said, I just changed my order to two, because I ordered one several years ago kind of thing, and I'm going to buy two because I'm going to sell the other one. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Why would you want to do that? Like, what's the point? Like, what are you going to make on that? What's the spread? I guess it's $150,000.
I was going to say, it's a decent spread if Joe's
I didn't think about it. Like, could you really sell it for a quarter million to this moment? But
That's the word. I don't know. I don't know what that looks like.
I suppose if you really want to be, that's somebody really, you know, deep into vanity. Really deep.
Yeah, they want to stand out.
Right?
They want to have the new thing.
And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, gosh, I'm right now on the black market for a Tesla Cybertruck, and I've just called you out, I'm sorry.
Well, but Adam can trade you his I don't know, his TV or something for your
maybe
Cybertruck. Sure. So, no, but it's a vanity thing though, right? So like I guess when him and his family are driving around and the people will just take pictures. So it's a nonstop thing. Like you feel like you're a celebrity even though you're just driving a truck.
Oh, yeah.
So
ballsy folks too. They will come into your vehicle and be like, let me look around. And like, no, just because it's a Cybertruck doesn't mean you get a chance just to invade my property here. Come on. But I mean, you kind of invite some of that by being, I suppose, a first mover, having something flashy, because that's just like, it's like peacocking. If you're peacocking, you're going to get looked at, okay? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's like the ultimate peacock on the road,
right,
by the way. Yeah.
I actually saw my first one in Omaha the other day.
No like, way.
Literally just one here, only one that I've seen. And I drive pretty frequently, so I think I would have seen other ones. And that's the reason why, when they first announced it, I'm like, okay, Blade Runner, this thing is cool. I actually wanted one. I know some people think they're really ugly. I think the end product was uglier
cool
than
looking.
The original thing they demoed. I thought it looked super cool. I wanted one, but I would never, ever buy one until they were commonplace on the road. I do not want to be the guy who is like, are you the Cybertruck guy? And then they're coming inside my vehicle and like asking me questions. For me, that's the most unattractive thing in life, is like to have to be the Cybertruck guy. Like that other guy in Omaha is.
So what was the other guy? Like, was it Warren Buffett or somebody? Like,
that would be kind of funny, actually. Probably was. So, I mean, that would be pretty cool.
He'd have to buy his used, though, and it has to be like 10 years old.
He probably bought two, and he sold one on the aftermarket. That guy knows how to make money.
He does. He does. It's funny, though. But, you know, my cousin actually lives diagonal from him, and I guess he still drives his Cadillac or whatever the hell it is. Mm-hmm. So it's just a beat-up old car.
Yeah.
Drives himself to work every day. Wouldn't even know it's him. But now I can't see him in a Cybertruck. But yeah, Omaha, it's interesting. Where in Omaha did you see the, for the audience, I was born in Omaha. So, but where in Omaha did you
West,
see
a Cybertruck?
West Omaha. Area. Okay, that seems like the place where people would have a Cybertruck is West Omaha.
Yeah.
So West Omaha is like the growing exurb, I suppose. Where everybody needs to be seen. So every city has one of those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's cool. What else on your guys' mind? I know we for the show we were talking about some other stuff. XC backdoors,
I mean,
job markets.
Backdoor is super interesting to me. I don't know if you follow this at all, Joe.
I haven't been following it much at all. I'd love to know your perspective on. Like, so for an idiot like me, like, what's going on with that?
Schoolless.
Sure. So XZ is this very obscure compression library that is maintained by one person, and it's inside of most Linuxes. You know, similar to like gzip or 7zip or these different compression algorithms. And XZ is built into many Linux distributions. It just so happens that it's, you know, stable old software, not all that interesting anymore, maintained by one person. And this is a very common thing in the open source world. You have all these obscure, very technical and maintained by one or a few people libraries. OpenSSL famously had the Heartbleed attack probably a decade ago now, whereas like open, where we all realize that the entire internet uses OpenSSL, and it's like two guys maintaining it and they're burnt out, right? And it's like, holy cow. Mm. Well, XZ is very much that same setup. It's less important, but actually the OpenSSH project uses XZ as a dependency. So OpenSSH is how most, you know, secure shell connections happen on the internet. And so what happened with XZ was there was a GitHub user by the name of like Giatan725. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there's a GitHub user that was created in 2021 and basically started to do modest open source contributions to look like a real person or like a, just a regular GitHub user. And they slowly worked their way into the good graces of the XZ maintainer, whose name I can't currently remember, but who's a fella who was looking for help for a long time, like just burnt out, didn't want to maintain it anymore, and was looking for help. And basically what happened was Giatan, who we don't think is a real person, but is the moniker of this user on GitHub, basically groomed the XZ maintainer into trusting Giatan with commit access. And then Giatan went on to insert a backdoor into XZ, a very sophisticated backdoor, and then quickly promote a new version of XZ, release a new version with this backdoor in it, and went around to like the Debian list and went around to Red Hat and like all these different distribution maintainers and like said, please upgrade XZ to this new version. And so that began to roll out to Linuxes all around the world with a SSH backdoor in it. So that allows an individual with a private key that they hold to basically have remote access to any computer that's running SSHD with that version of XZ compression enabled. That's the setup. Now, then what happened was very interesting. So that was all just like quiet. No one knows about it, right? Giatan did their thing, basically hacking, you know, setting up a backdoor that was going to be broadly available. It began to roll out to Linuxes, and it just so happens that a Microsoft researcher by the name of Frund, I can't remember his first name, Andres Frund, perhaps? Let me see if that name is correct. Yes, Andres Frund, who works for Microsoft and was doing some research in his day job, was running like bleeding edge versions of Linux, which had this vulnerability in it, which most people didn't have yet because it was slowly rolling out. And he was doing some different benchmarking tests on his computer and was running SSHD and realized that logins to SSHD were 500 milliseconds slower than normal. I mean, this is like a SSH whisperer kind of a fella. Like, who would notice this? Apparently, he was doing micro benchmarks. And so any activity on his computer, he was like very highly tuned into the fact that this particular process was like using more CPU than it normally does. And so he just like pulled on that thread. He's like, why is SSHD using so much CPU? And he like went to the source code and, you know, backtracked it all the way back and found this backdoor before it rolled out to the world.
Oh, wow.
So he like caught it on the bleeding edge. And so like a few Linuxes had it, but not very many. Only hackers who were on the bleeding edge basically got it. And so he caught it and notified and released a, you know, they patched it, et cetera, and blew the whole thing, you know, the whole back door up before it did its damage. And this all happened last week. And so just fascinating, the whole story, the way it was found. I don't know if you've ever seen this clip of Steph Curry dribbling the basketball. You ever see Steph Curry find a dead spot on the basketball court? It's a very popular short video. Steph Curry's driving, or he's not driving, he's just dribbling. It's like pregame. And he's dribbling across the lane by himself, just, and he notices, because he actually fumbles the dribble, which Steph Curry's not going to do, and he finds this dead spot on the basketball court because he couldn't believe that he actually didn't dribble it correctly. And he goes back and he tests it, and the whole video is him basically like being this super expert at dribbling, finds a dead spot on the court, and it just shows how good Steph Curry is at dribbling. Dang. That's what this guy was like with SSH daemon. Like, he's like the only, maybe the only person in the world that would have noticed. And he noticed. And he blew the lid on it. And so they rolled out a patch and everything's fine. And then they go looking for Gia Tan. So Gia Tan's account gets, GitHub account gets canceled. Also the maintainer, whose name I'm forgetting right now, his account got suspended. He had nothing to do with it. He just happened to trust this person.
Mm-hmm.
And this person wasn't alone. They had sock puppet accounts that were like suggesting to the maintainer to trust Gia Tan and like putting more pressure on him to maintain the thing. So it was very coordinated. And people are thinking it's probably not just your average hacker. It's probably some sort of state-sponsored thing trying to backdoor the world. So that's the story.
Wow. When was the commit to the backdoor? Like, how was it years ago, you said, or was it recent?
So 2021 was when Gia Tan's account was created.
Right.
And the commit that got landed was a couple months ago, I believe. It was recently.
Okay.
But it was like a grooming process, basically.
So
in order to gain the trust
process
of the maintainer. And to act like you're a real person and not just, you know,
right,
an account who's trying to hack somebody.
And then the commit got landed, a new release was done, and then they went out and pressured the Debians, the Red Hats, the distros, essentially, to upgrade XZ.
Which they started to. But they were all on their, like, you know, Debian SID, which is like the experimental version of Debian. It wasn't actually live long enough to make it into the main rollout. But right, had this stayed there and gone undiscovered for maybe another few months, this backdoor would have rolled out to like pretty much every Linux machine around the world.
I'm just looking at his email from March 29th, Andres Freund.
Yeah.
Basically, hi, sentence or two. The upstream XZ repository and the XZ tarballs have been backdoored.
Yeah.
Continue your explanation.
Yep. Very matter of fact.
Wow.
What are the odds, though? The one person that could discover it does discover it.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, like, then there's there could conspiracy be more people, theories but... like, well, maybe that they wanted this to happen. You know, like maybe somebody put Andres Freund up to it, or, you know, everybody's speculating because nobody knows what exactly went down. I mean, we know what happened historically, but, you know, how did he discover this thing? His story seems to check out. I mean, it makes sense that what he was doing and why he'd be paying super close attention, because he was doing some micro benchmarking, but fascinating stuff. So Filippo Valsorda, who's a recurring guest on our show and a very smart security researcher, he went through and did a technical breakdown of the exploit that actually creates the backdoor. And what he said was this: this might be the best executed supply chain attack we've seen described in the open, and it's a nightmare scenario. Malicious, competent, authorized upstream in a widely used library. So like, we really dodged a bullet. Like, the world dodged a bullet there. And then you wonder, how many bullets are we not dodging? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it puts a lot of pressure, I suppose, on obviously security, but I'm just thinking, like, how many people just have no idea? Like you were saying earlier, Joe, like, how often we talk to folks, everyday folks, not tech folks, mm-hmm, about AI. It's kind of like that. Like, these people are, like, in a way oblivious to, like, the hero saving the world, you know, that kind of thing that you see only in, like, sci-fi movies or whatever, or, you know, blockbuster movies. Is this moment where I suppose what could have happened is if this backdoor was available to all these Linux distros, there are nuclear plants that are run on Linux, I'm sure, some variation of their computer systems. Like, how in the world can we actually be secure, do you think? I mean, we have socket.dev out there, which is amazing. You've got Sneak and others who are, like, on the security fronts, but they're doing CVEs, which is, like, really after the exploit is aware, right? Mm-hmm. Socket is preventative and, you know, on the offense, whereas, like, Sneak and others are on the defense after it's happened, kind of thing, and educating folks. And I'm sure it's more elaborate than that, but I'm just being paraphrasing here on what I think they actually do. How can we actually have better security? Like, is it even possible?
I don't know. It kind of goes back to our discussion earlier about old school and new school, right? I think that there's an argument to be made that the a lot of the dumb machines, you know, we're talking consumer stuff or whatever, but I'll talk about another example in a second. But I mean, those those were secure precisely because you could understand them and work on them. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity to introduce, you know, backdoors like this. I mean, looking through this, I need to read it. This is on OpenWall, Andreas's email, but that's looks very, very sophisticated. Like it you is. Would, I mean, yeah, I'm just looking at like, wow. I mean, you know, as an example in the, you know, in the physical world, what was it, a month or two ago, the Wall Street Journal had an article about how, all the cranes and shipping ports are mostly from Chinese origin. And there's a lot of concern about these. And so they're having to go back and retrofit or remove these and get rid of them. Because in the event of, maybe, I don't know, say a geopolitical conflict, those right. cranes could be weaponized.
Yeah.
Right? And your entire port shut down. So, or worse. So that's like... So it just makes you wonder, like,
conditions checkbox, like, you know, must to start machine must comply to terms and conditions. And if you don't, then it no run kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it does make you wonder how much of this stuff is out there, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, I imagine it's probably everywhere, you know, just kind of lurking. I mean, because this just happened to get found out, as you pointed out,
exactly.
Jared. It's like this guy. Yeah, sort of the Steph Curry like dribbling the ball just accidentally finds it. It wasn't like he is looking for dead spots.
Right. He wasn't like a person who was paid to find back doors.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, this isn't the first supply chain attack that we've mm-hmm. seen either. I mean, this is a common thing, especially the move where, I mean, this required two things. First, a very technically adept attacker, right? Like, I've been in security and I've been in software for 20 years and I read through the technical details of how this worked and I kind of checked out. I was like, okay, this is over my head. So it's very, very sophisticated. And then the social engineering and the patience, right? Yeah. Like this didn't start when they found a back door or an exploit where they could put in a back door and then decided to get it out there. This started years ago. And so how many of these are going on? They're just waiting for their opportunity. And then you have this dichotomy, which is these open source maintainers, the solo maintainer maintaining core internet infrastructure in their spare time that runs the world, and they're sick of it, or they're busy, or their life implodes, or whatever happens, mm-hmm. and they're crying for help, and no one's helping them. And here comes somebody who finally is going to help them, and that person is abusing them. I mean, it seems almost untenable that we can just survive like this, you know, ongoing. And not have some serious events.
Well, what should you do? Is, I guess, one way to sort of counteract that could be to make a list of, you know, high value projects that should have maybe more in industry support of sorts. I'm not really sure how to describe that. And I would imagine even upstream to GitHub, some user account regulation, like, I suppose it's a multi-year account, so how can you do that? It seems very normal, seems very, you know, typical, right. individual, not, like you said, Jared, a moniker of someone else, a false person. How can, I'd like to actually talk to GitHub's security team on, like, how they deal with user security. Maybe they could talk about that, maybe they can't, but I'd be fascinated to talk about how they mitigate a lot of this, maybe unspeakable, a lot of this in a lot of cases, like they just can't say it because it just only gives more information to the bad folks trying to circumvent. But something's got to happen, or probably is happening, at the user level, user account level at GitHub, on GitHub accounts. So something there has to be, like Socket. I mentioned socket.dev. The way they handle things is basically look at various telltale signs in a repository. Has there been a new contributor? You know, has somebody recently got new keys? Was a new thing added to it that does like file system type things, like weird things a thing should not do that is backdoor or security vulnerabilities? All these little telltale signs of changes in repository to the individuals, to the code base, to, you know, all these different things. And it's precursors to what might be a malicious opportunity, may not actually be malicious. And I think that's the way to go too, is you got to have more, you know, more awareness on that front and more data points on that front. But I think GitHub's probably holding a lot of the bag in terms of responsibility, right? Like that's where the origination is kind of happening. Like if you can't have commit access, it requires a GitHub account essentially, if it's open source and it's primarily on GitHub. Mm. A user account is required. So some level of security on contributors and maintainers to high profile, potential high profile targets would mm-hmm. be smart.
It's really interesting. And you also bring up the, I think Jared, you brought up the point of the person being potentially burned out mm-hmm. who's maintaining this. And it's, you sort of see this around with other open source projects where it's usually a person or two or maintaining very important stuff. Like, so who is it? Max Howell. Have you ever talked to him?
Yeah.
From Homebrew? Yeah. I mean, same thing with Homebrew, like single-handedly maintained that for a while until he got other people to do it. But it's like, he was making no money off it. And he had to go get a, he had to go get a job because he's. Mm-hmm. It turns out when you have even if you have the, one of the most popular open source tools in the world, it's no guarantee you're going to make a anything resembling a living off of it. Right. So it just grinds at you after a while, right? That's why he's doing TXYZ right now, which is a way to hopefully remunerate open source contributors and
yeah. give them,
you know. But even that's hard. So.
What's really hard is finding someone. I mean, Max did a good job. He handed off Homebrew mm-hmm. to very competent people who've been
yeah.
doing it for many years. Mike McQuaid's a friend of ours. He's the current lead maintainer, has been for, what do you say, Adam? I think 12, 13, 14, 15 yeah. years. I mean,
a long time.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. And they have like governance, yes. they have people doing it, but it's a very successful, very user-facing project. Mm-hmm. And so the ones that really go under the, you know, under wraps are the dependencies of the dependencies of the dependencies, right? Like they yeah. are down in there and they are very difficult to hand off. I mean, you have to find somebody who's incredibly skilled at this particular technology, whatever it happens to be, has free time and availability and is interested and has some sort of reason to help you. That's not, those don't exist lots of times. And so there's lots of maintainers who would love to pass off their project to somebody. And there's just nobody. And so, I mean, my heart goes out to the guy because he finally found somebody competent who's willing to help him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they go and do this. I mean, that's depressing.
Man, shrewd on the attacker's part, though. I mean, that yeah. you know, I mean, not saying what they did was great, but I mean, that seemed very, very well played.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. And to your point, Adam, I don't know how GitHub could ever have said this account is probably a malicious actor until after the fact. I mean, it's so normal. Like you go check these, it's suspended now, but there's people who have cloned it and checked it and, you know, they go back to the history. Cause of course, who is GSAN is now, you know, not quite as big as who's Satoshi Nakamoto, but still a mystery now that people are trying to solve at this point.
Yeah.
And from what I read, it was like, yeah, this looks like a very typical GitHub user, you know? And then you have the false positive. Now GitHub starts suspending accounts of regular people around the world. I mean, that's the worst.
Well, I think it can be one layer, maybe better than that, is verification. So I experienced this recently. Like when we flew back from, gosh, where were we at, Jared? I think we were in Chicago. And I was like late getting to the airport. And thankfully, I think to your suggestion, even because you had recently gotten like TSA pre-check or whatever, and you're mm-hmm. like, you should do that. I'm like, I've been thinking about getting Clear, and Clear is basically a verification process with your government IDs. Like it takes a process. You got to do a photo. You got to put your finger, like it's very much like, this is you. You have to use government IDs. And LinkedIn recently added this thing where you can verify your LinkedIn profile because there's real people on LinkedIn, right? Like that's how mm-hmm. it works. Sure, there's real people on GitHub too, but they're not verified. And this is one credit that I like about LinkedIn is if you see that check mark or that it's not like the Twitter/X check or whatever that is. It's more like a verified thing that you have connected LinkedIn to Clear, that you are truly who you say you are. I think if we could tie the profiles or harden the profiles back to a real person, because if GSAN is not a real person, then they would have not have passed that, you know, not just real human check because anybody can create an account, but mm-hmm. real human as in really somebody that is, you know, known by a government agency, a citizen of a particular country, you know, IP address matches country of origin. Like there's checks in that process of proving personhood mm-hmm. that I think I would be open to GitHub having because of just now it's such a large target to circumvention. Like this is like if GSAN, if they had some sort of requirement to say you have to be a real person, like verified or like Clear is with LinkedIn, mm-hmm. then I think this might have mitigated that potentially, or at least put one more layer of, like you said, they're very patient too. So maybe they could have gotten around that, but at least it's one more layer to tying it back to a real human.
Yeah, I think that could be a step. I think that probably that should happen at the repository level. Like, as an owner of a repository, I can say only verified people can contribute to my repository, mm-hmm. versus dictating it from the platform. But then you go around and you say, okay, similar to how they did it with signed signatures and stuff, mm-hmm. like they just made it a social norm to like, hey, you need to secure, or I guess with 2FA, they had certain things that they made 2FA required. But, you know, certain repositories, it's like, look, this is just too important. You know, this is not your dot files or like some random side project. Yeah. This is core internet infrastructure, and we want to know who's committing to it. I could see that being a step. Now, could somebody who's as sophisticated as whoever this was circumvent that? Possibly. But yeah, layers. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what you got to do. Add layers.
A lot of layers. Well, especially now that you have I was reading, what was it last week, about new attacks that are happening with generated code. So AI generated code, mm. where it'll just like point you to a malicious GitHub repo that you can just download as a package. So that's, I don't know, man. It's getting really fun.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of this, I had to share this story last night. I almost, and I'm like seriously, almost got phished. I was the closest something I'd ever actually gotten to being phished. There was, and I reported to Stripe too. I got an email recently, Jared, that says payouts paused for changelog.com, annual KYC required. Seemed very legit. Look at it. It's a Stripe email, all that good stuff. I didn't even pay attention to who it was from though. And now that I look back, I'm like, it could have been a little bit more obvious, but because it was so like, oh, payouts are paused. Now, just the week beforehand, I had actually gone and done a profile update because Stripe just did some sort of triggered thing to say you need to go and, you know, do a normal profile update, tie in some real information. And I had just done this, and I was actually almost screenshotted it and like angry man on front lawn styled it, was like, you know, I just did this last week. What's wrong with you? Like, is Stripe the new PayPal, essentially, like locking me out of my account? And so I got angry, and I was like, I'm excited to get over this because I thought I just squashed this bug, basically. Click the verify business email link that's in the thing. It looks very Stripe, the whole entire email. And as soon as my tab opens up in the browser, I notice, obviously, that it's not Stripe.com. Quickly, as fast as I possibly can, you know, Command-W, and close that tab. And I go back to the email immediately and like, okay, wow, this passed like my frustrated brain situation, and it fished me for a moment, and like then I was thinking, well, what information is in my cookies that it can like grab mm-hmm. about me, that it can sort of sniff even though I didn't take an action? Did somehow this click do something on my machine? I obviously immediately, because I've watched Mr. Robot, I know how these things happen, right? I immediately updated my password for Stripe to a much more brand new secure version of it. And I think I redid my 2FA and all that good stuff to use 1Password instead of my verified application. So I just basically went back and hardened my security around my Stripe profile, essentially. But this email was very compelling. Like, I thought it was really Stripe. I reported it. So by the way, if you're listening to this and you've ever had this, phishing@stripe.com is who you should, you know, forward those emails to. Now, I haven't heard back from them, but I can see that 18 hours ago they opened my email address, or they opened my email to them. So they at least got this information that this phishing email went to me, got me. Just a click, at least. I didn't take no action. I just clicked the link. But that to me is pretty close, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they almost got me.
Yeah.
I mean, you seem like a pretty savvy guy, though, right, Adam? I mean, how did you feel about this?
I'm wearing shame right now. I'm only, because I'm a podcaster and it's always recording, I have to lay it out there. I mean, if I was just any old person, I would tell nobody. I'm so in shame right now because I clicked that link, for real. And I'm like boastfully in shame, which is, you know, an oxymoron, really. But I think what I'm trying to communicate really is like, I do feel like I'm a pretty savvy guy. I feel like I do see things pretty frequently, and I can smell the nasty, I suppose, in the world. And that to me is like, they got by me. And if they did it to me, they can do it to anybody's grandmother. I've got a friend who's got their parent who is just like mentally not well because she's getting older. But, you know, these people prey. They're predatory on certain folks in the world. And I mean, Stripe got this thing with Stripe. That was a whole different thing. But like, if that can get me and I'm in a moment vulnerable because I'm like, oh my gosh, I just dealt with this KYC thing. Here they are again. Like, what did I not do right? You know? So maybe the person out there who did this or the persons who did this knew they just did this thing to a lot of their user base because it's a standard thing probably to do. And they leveraged that. Okay, a week later, I'm going to send another email to somebody and fish them.
Not just to somebody, but to everybody. I mean, that's why these things work, is because it's just a numbers game, right? So if they send it to 1 million, they'll catch 2. And because the cost of sending an email to 1 million is low enough, you know, the numbers play out. So
where I'm really frustrated at with the world is phone calls.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Phone calls. They will mimic versions of your own phone number. So they'll take your, obviously, your first 3 digits, your area code, and then the same middle 3 digits as your own phone number, which I will not say what mine are. And they will make sameness or similarness the attribute for which to get your attention to answer the phone call. I don't know about you guys. I can't not answer my phone, okay? Because some calls are from numbers that I don't know. And they're not my contacts, and I do need to take the phone call.
Yep.
Right? So I have to, like, it's a human nature. I feel like I'm not at a point in my life where I cannot answer my phone.
Well, I don't answer mine.
You don't answer yours at all?
Unless it's somebody that I know. Like, it's on my contact list. Yeah, I figure if it's important, leave a voicemail. I'll call you back. If it's not important, then I'm just not going to answer.
Same.
Yeah, I used to be there. I just can't do that.
Can't, too nice.
I just can't do it.
Could be an emergency.
And these people... Hey, this is Mary Jane over here. We got a notification that you submitted an application for new health insurance. How's that treating you or whatever? Like, hey, you've called 17 times. I've told you to stop calling. Well, you didn't ask me. Well, I'm asking you now, so please stop calling. What do you know about your health insurance? You need, like, lady, listen, okay, I've already told you, please stop. And these people are probably just, like, trying to make their money, and I can't really, I mean... I think you can choose your job, but like I would probably try my best to not choose that job if I had to have a choice. But then I also understand what it's like to have limited choice.
Yeah.
I've been there too in my life, and that sucks, really. And I, at one point, I was a telemarketer in my life, early in my life. I was like 18 years old, like super young. I was
great. I've done that job too. It sucks.
I did it as well.
Yep.
This was back.
This is how you become podcast host, by the way. Is you telemarketer.
That's right. That's right. How much do you pay for your AT&T long distance service? Oh, I could save you some cents. That was my
pretty good at this actually.
I was doing magazine renewals, so mine wasn't so bad because it is bad because by the time they put a human on the phone, you've decided not to renew that magazine like 6 or 7 times.
Oh
like,
yeah,
we are the last ditch effort because it's the most expensive way. And yet still some people I call and be like, hey, I'm calling about your National Geographic. And they're like, oh, man, I can't. I'm so glad you called. Yeah, renew that sucker, you know. But 9 times out of 10. So it wasn't that bad. It was an easier sell than I think long distance plans and stuff because it was a magazine that you had. But then there's all the people who are like, I let that thing expire 6 months ago. Get off my phone. You know, like the reactions just were wildly different. But.
The worst for me was raising money for American Cancer Society. I mean, a great effort, but wow. You know, to be good at that one in particular. And we would have bonuses where if you raise this much in this hour, and I'm young, like, I want that $100, okay? I'm going to do good at my job. And so I'm going to say, I'm sorry, Joe, do you really not want to help young Sally here who's got leukemia? You can't find $5 to
definitely
share
not. With, don't want to help right? her.
Yeah. See, what terrible human.
Like, that's what I would have to do leukemia. To folks. So, I mean, the phone right now totally sucks. Like, I want to solve
don't
that. So, I mean, I want it to be solved that bad. I don't plan to solve it, but I wish at regulation, like Verizon, T-Mobile, like at some level, they've got to know about this traffic on their network, right? I mean, somebody's got to fix this. Who's responsible for this brokenness?
Well, I'm sure. Do you guys get text messages too? Phishing ones? Yeah. So I got one the other day from some, her name and her picture. Yeah, she looks Chinese. She's like, hey, haven't seen you for a while. I'm like, haven't seen you ever. Actually, I didn't reply. I just delete, because the moment you start replying is the moment that they start replying as well, very aggressively. I had one where it was, and this is another, this is clever. So they're like, hey, you know, what's up, Dan? Like, you know, you come to the party tonight or something like that. It's like, hey, no, you know, like, hey, and it ends up being some like lady or something, like, hey, what's up? You want to go like hang out? I'm like, no, nah, definitely not with you. And so that was one. And then the ones where they get you is like, hey, like your mom's really sick. You know, and of course you know, this pulls your emotions, because like, well, obviously if this was intended for the right person, it has to get there, right? So you're gonna say, oh, sorry, wrong number. Right. And they open up the dialogue there. Yeah, like, hey, do you want to get dinner? And it's like, didn't you say my friend's dying and stuff? But yeah, whatever. Exactly. It's fine. So
there's a logical leap there from like the first message to the second one. Like they need a better transition.
Instantaneous, of course. Yeah. Well, I mean, these aren't the people that are going to be doing the XE backdoor thing, by the
right,
way.
Right. Yeah. These are unsophisticated actors. Yeah, exactly.
They're preying on loneliness, really. I mean, like the state of the humanity. Like, we're at a precedent where now the young generation is like anxious is the biggest thing they feel. Anxiety, anxiousness. And I just truly believe it's like the smartphone in some ways. Like, not the only thing, but one of many things. Because even as an older adult, I feel it. I mean, I use my phone more than I'm comfortable with. And I try to curb it. But there's a lot of my life that happens as a part of it. But the moment or moments whenever I'm like bored or whatever, and I'm not even sure I would term it that, just like not in a state of activity, I'm somehow on my phone in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Whether it's email, whether it's LinkedIn, whether it's X, whether it's Slack. I mean, you name it, there's a reason why, there's a reason to be involved in it. It's frustrating.
Does that make you lonely?
I mean, I think
this is why he brushes his teeth a lot.
Yeah, so I can see myself. I have that problem. No, not lonely, but I think that we're in a place where, you know, there's a lot of folks who are. They're desperate and they're lonely.
Yeah, it's true.
They're desperate for a friend. Friend connections are down more than ever in life. I mean, it's challenging to meet people that are deep. We call them bullseye friends. Around my parts, like, we're trying to teach our young kids about what friend group they should put somebody in based upon certain things about that person or whatever. Not trying to, like, just helping them filter people out. You know, okay, obviously this person is less good for you because they're making these choices and they're trying to get you involved in that. So you could be friends with them. You don't have to obviously hate them, because we're not trying to encourage hate. But we're trying to encourage, like, hey, just because you're friendly and friends with them doesn't mean they have to be in your core, in your center, like a, you know, like a dartboard in a way. Like, they're not a bullseye friend. So, okay, we're trying to teach the kid that friend there, you see how they care for you, see how they reciprocate your friendship, you see how they share with you, you see how they speak kindly to you. That person is a bullseye worthy friend. That's the kind of person you want to invest more into. And I think that you have people out there that are just desperate and lonely for a friendship.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, hey, I know your mom just died, but maybe dinner's good for you.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it's not that your mom did not die. Yeah, the bullseye friend is, yeah, just to clarify.
Yeah, let's go to dinner now. That's awesome. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, as parents, you know, we're, you know, they're like an arrow, right? They're a quiver in our arrow, and we got to fire them away into the world. At some point, we're prepping these young children to go out into the world, and they'll be released. And our jobs as parents is to enable them to fly straight and hit their target in life, you know?
I like that.
And you can't do that unless you do the guiding, right? You can't be an absent parent. You have to be an involved parent. And that's even a challenge, too, with nuclear families. Like, two parents both working, not having a lot of, and it's not really their fault. It's like, whose fault is it, really? some parents have to both work to make the ends meet. Now, obviously, you can make different choices, buy different houses, not have two cyber trucks, you know, that kind of thing, you know, for $250,000 each.
Sell one.
Right. Salary. You can make different choices to not have to make so much money.
Reach out to the American Cancer Society. Right. You sold your Cybertruck. So.
But you got to have time to invest in your kids. You got to have time to be there for those moments for them and to, you know, be there for them in their sports and their activities. And they're going to remember that in their life and leverage that in their life way more than obviously that you as a parent not being present, you know?
Yeah, Cybertruck will come and go.
Right.
I think a novelty wore off for my brother-in-law's kids within the first day. They're like, right. Okay. Then they're just like dumping Cheetos in the back and like watching the, because they have a TV in the back of it too. And the Cybertruck's in the A's. It's like, and look at the car. It's like, this is a disaster. And you've only had this thing for like a week.
This Cybertruck's a dump. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, the kids don't care. Right. No, you're absolutely right, Adam. It's just, you know, how do you, what do you teach them? I mean, I'm trying to, you know, teach my kids definitely, I guess, quote, 21st century, even though we're quarter way through it already. Skills like that. I feel like the way probably all of us grew up is maybe not the way that, you know, society's going to be going.
I don't know,
like,
man.
Jobs, for instance, right? I think the nature of work's going to change, but there's certain things that don't change, right? Like having a work ethic, like bringing yourself to work and doing, you know, the best you can with the, you know, with the talent you have. Like, that's not going to change. But I feel like the really bad advice is, you know, definitely, you know, focus on getting the career that you're going to have for a really long time and work at the same job. Like, that hasn't existed for ages, but I still hear this advice at school sometimes. I think it's kind of crazy. You know, one of the things we talked about before the show too is a job market. I'd love to talk about this for a bit. I think it's a prescient thing. I mean, the world I come from is the data job market, and that's, you know, that I think if you're an AI, you're killing it, absolutely killing it. But that's like the only place.
The only ones.
It feels like, you know, so I was at a Java meetup last month here in Salt Lake City, and you know, one of my friends, she's a recruiter, very popular recruiter in the city. And, you know, normally she's talking about how there's plenty of jobs, right? You know, it's age of abundance. This is the only time I ever saw her come up and say, look, job market's really bad. There really aren't any jobs. But if you need somebody who can at least, you know, a shoulder to cry on or somebody to help guide you in the, you know, in your job search, let me know. I'm happy to help. That was the first time I heard that. And this is more geared towards software engineers and people like that. What are y'all seeing out there?
Well, just today, Amazon announced they are cutting hundreds of jobs inside of AWS specifically, which if there's been a good place to work in the last 10 years, I think AWS is one of them in terms of just job security and salaries, right? Like, people get paid very well there, but even they are cutting. I'm just surprised that it continues to go on, as I just am like, haven't y'all laid off enough people yet? You got to keep laying off more people. I don't completely understand that. It felt like we had reached some kind of an end at the end of last year, and into January there wasn't much talk of layoffs, and then it was like, you know, February, March hit, and it just, like, in the tech sector specifically, I don't really watch too many other sectors. They just keep rolling out more and more layoffs. And I'm not sure how long this is going to last. Mm-hmm. But like you said, Joe, there's been so much. And there's a lot of, I think, potentially upper management somewhat drunk on the possibility of AI replacing the need for, you know, certain headcounts. That I think it's, the layoffs are one thing, but it sounds like it's really hard to find a new role right now.
It sounds really hard.
Yeah.
I talk to people who, you know, these are people who had no problem finding tech work in the good days, I guess. And like, some of these people are a year plus out of work right now. And I can just tell it is eating at them. Like, they're depressed. They're very, very depressed. And it's hard. And I hear this universally from people too. Like, people with a ton of experience, hard to find work. People with no experience, impossible to find work almost. And the advice I give to people is that, you know, it's the same advice whether you're new or old in your career. But it, you know, Zig Ziglar had this old saying, it's corny as hell, but it's true. Your net worth is your net worth, is what he would say. But it's very, very true. The people who I see are landing jobs are the ones that have good networks, and, you know, they're finding the stuff that's usually not advertised. Because if you're applying, I mean, I have friends that have submitted thousands of applications and haven't heard back from on anything. And that, that's demoralizing. I don't care who you are. Like, you take a swing at something for 1,000 times and can't even get anything mm-hmm. close to a hit. Like, it's gonna wear on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. I do agree with that. Your network is your net worth.
I've been a big network, my whole life. I mean, if you're sitting there thinking, okay, I don't have a job, I want one. I don't have a network. Maybe you're either fresh out of school or you've had one job and then got laid off, and maybe you know like 7 people that you worked with and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
What, I mean, can you just say, go on LinkedIn and just hit like connect with every single person you find? That doesn't seem to work all that well.
I find that's, yeah, I hate when people do that. Like, but a lot of people like will hit me up and the next thing is like, hey, do you have any jobs for me? And I'm like, no. Unfollow and remove the connection, because it's like I would say don't be transactional. Right. I would say that if you're in a city like or in a location where there's meetups, go to those and just start meeting people. Like, I think that's personally how I feel is the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. And just put the time in. It might be months before anything even starts to feel like it makes sense, but I would approach it from a mindset that you're trying to meet people, trying to learn from people, and expect nothing else. Don't go to it transactionally. People can see right through it.
Yeah.
But this is how you build your network. At least in my experience, again, your mileage may vary depending on where you are. And if you're in a very rural, isolated area, then I don't know. That's a good question. Mm-hmm. So
it's not easy and it takes time. I mean, you can't build a network overnight, not a real one that people, like you said, because if you're transactional, mm-hmm. they're just very cheap. Those transactions are very cheap. And everything's kind of quid pro quo and it feels icky. And it's like, that's not real. Real mm-hmm. relationships take time to develop, you know? And so real networks, I think, that have real value, you can't build overnight. You have to kind of invest as you go. And it's tough, though, when you're in a situation where you're like, okay, now I really need help and I don't have a network yet. Mm-hmm. You can't say, well, start building one in 6 years. It'll be really useful for you, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, I have some friends that are applying to other jobs, like at the post office now, right? People who were in tech making a lot of good money. And now it's like, I'll take this $40,000 a year job at the post office, I guess, because that's what I can do. But that's the reality that I'm seeing out there right now. It's not great. So
yeah.
Hopefully it gets better. I mean, I'm usually very optimistic, you know, despite appearances, but it's...
Well, I'll say this, probably never a better time to start a business. I mean,
this is very true.
So cheap to start a business, so much opportunity. And if you're out of work anyways, you know, and you need something to do, take a crack at it. You know, like mm-hmm. the risk, you know, people who have full-time jobs that last a long time, like job security is the thing that they value. Well, it's like, well, we don't have much job security.
Do you really have it? Yeah.
Or do you have an illusion of it? So mm-hmm. if you've got something to build with, good time to give it a shot.
I got a couple ideas I would love to do if I had different time or more time, or just like if I just something changed, I'd probably make some pizzas. I'd probably start a pizza shop.
Hell yeah. Really good,
dude, I mean, love pizza.
Everybody values really good pizza.
People love right? pizza.
This is true.
And then your chains are not, in my opinion, really good pizza. They're available and accessible pizza, usually with delivery. Not always the best service. I mean, even Domino's, you order from an app. There's no humanity. It's transactional pizza. You know, you want right. pizza with humanity.
No, local.
You know, you want something that's local, something that breathes life into your community, something that's local first.
I like pizza.
The other idea.
Well, I'm just going to mention to Jared, you know, my favorite pizza place, one of my favorite pizza places in the world is La Casa over in Omaha.
Oh, yeah.
It's awesome. Like, that place has been around since I was a baby and... Thin crust, good pizza.
So many good pizza places here, man. If you like good food, I mean, there's not very many reasons to come to Omaha, honestly. Maybe College World Series. Maybe you can hang out with me, have a beer. We do have a decent zoo. But if you like good food, we have more restaurants per capita than any city in America, I heard. I've never double-checked that, so fact-check me. But it's tough to make it here in a restaurant because there's always a restaurant right across the street. And so the ones that survive are really good. Because mm-hmm. they aren't yeah. transactional, Adam, there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good pizzas.
What was your other idea?
What's your other idea? Come on, give away another one.
I would do something in the... Now, I haven't fully vetted this out. I think it'd be fun. I'm not sure how fun it would be to actually run the business. I'm not sure how profitable it would be. I haven't done the economics fully. But I would love to do like an outdoor laser tag thing like here in Texas. with like teams and make it, you know, it's fitness, it's community driven. You know, this is a business eventually I'm going to do with my son. At some point, we're going to do this. I won't tell you the name because it's just so good. I'll tell you off air. And one day, we're going to buy a couple acres of land, 3-5 acres, whatever. Maybe even have some lodging on it, have a little destination, and people can come and hang out and watch. They can come out and participate. But it'll be like good outdoor laser tag for kids, for adults, for anybody. I've experienced it somewhere and they do it well, but it's not their main attraction. I'm like, you've undersold to me the coolest thing you have here. The water park is great, but I think this other thing is really well done. They have leaderboards, you compete, you know, you got red team and blue team. It's like, it's super cool, right? And there's a lot of opportunity in that space.
Oh yeah.
I think to just have a fun business, even if it's not the most profitable, it'd be a very fun business to run.
Oh, I was just at an arcade yesterday with my kids. We went to this, it's called Nickel Mania. They just have like 80s arcade games.
That's a cool name.
It's a cool name and it's a great business. I mean,
it
was
Quarter Mania, but
Quarter Mania,
sure. All right.
That's inflation.
It was packed though. It was packed. Part of it, spring break is happening right now where I am. But I mean, it was packed to the gills with kids. And every time I go there, it's packed. I was just sitting there running the numbers like, okay, this place actually probably makes some really good money. It's $250 entry fee plus video games. And, but you know, when I compare it to, if I were doing the numbers on that versus a restaurant, I'm like, okay, no overhead. If you're talking about table turns, which is one of the metrics you use in restaurants, like this place kills.
Yeah.
Absolutely kills it.
Do they have pinball?
They have lots of pinball machines.
There goes all their margins. You know, you're just sinking all your revenue into fixing those suckers.
Yeah.
Things are so expensive to fix.
They are expensive.
Gosh. But that's a cool place for sure.
Yeah. I think you're onto something though. I mean, you know, it is a good time to start a business. I think, you know, all of us, I don't know if you guys have 9-to-5s, but I mean, I've been running my businesses for a long, long time. I couldn't imagine going back and getting a 9-to-5. There's a short list of companies I'd consider, but at this point, it's like I'm having more fun doing being feral. I don't know.
Yeah.
So
same.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I can't work for somebody else. I don't think. I think that's I'm unemployable.
I might be as well. I'm not sure. I haven't tried it in so long, but I might be unemployable.
I do think that, you know, not that I'm tooting my horn, but I think I have a lot of like unique, diverse skills that I'm like, I don't know. I think I would just cross, like I couldn't do one job. I would just like do many jobs.
Well, you work in a small business. People wear lots of hats in small business.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I would just, I don't know, I would like solve other people's problems and like not just do my job, but like do somebody else, a version Everybody of else's somebody job. Else's job too. Yeah. They'd be like, what are you doing? Like, that's their job. Let them do their, but like, hey, I don't know. I'm a control freak, I suppose, in those ways.
Totally.
Yeah, I think I might be unemployable.
I think honestly. We all collectively are. Yeah.
Probably.
Well, the advice back to your friend going to the post office job, which is like, you know, hey, if that's what you, if you feel like that's your only option, then that's okay. And there's nothing wrong with that by any means. But I think what Jared said, and I would also echo, is like just encourage folks, you know, whenever you seem like you have no options and you feel like you can be entrepreneurial and take a risk, then look at your interests, something you're truly passionate about. Like I've been super passionate about pizza for a while. I'm starting getting into like making my own pizza at home and stuff like that. I've got a literal direct neighbor who's really good at it. And he's been like educating me on some things. And at some point in my life, I'm not dying to like, or itching, I should say, to do a pizza shop. But I am a fan of pizza enough that I only go to the good places, right? I'm not ordering Domino's. I'm not ordering Marco's. These are two places that are near me that are basically chains, you know?
Valentino's?
I don't know about that place.
Pizza Hut?
I would go to Pizza Hut back in the 80s.
Pizza back in the 80s was pretty good.
Yeah, it was.
They used to have the book it thing you would do when you were a kid and you read books.
Book it. I forgot about book it.
Remember book it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You get personal pan pizza.
Personal pan pizza. Yeah.
I used to work at a Pizza Hut. You know how much oil is in that damn thing?
Oh, gosh.
It's like literally a cup of oil for a personal pan pizza.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's like this squirt a lot in there. And I'm like, okay, I'll do that.
They just like laid in there. Now, if it's extra virgin olive oil, then that's okay for you. So they say.
I think this is not that.
No, that's too expensive.
But
it's just like canola or something.
Castor oil.
When your options seem limited like that, and you feel like you don't have anywhere else to go, sometimes it might be best to look at your own thing. Like, what's missing in the market you wish would change?
Yeah.
And, you know, consider, are you the person that can start to make that change? I got another friend who created the Hot Box. You can look this up, the Hot Box. And it was during the pandemic. They wanted a sauna in their house. They didn't have a lot of space. And so they built this cockpit-style sauna. It's a single person. You don't have to put it outside or build it. It's really, really interesting how they built this thing. You get into it. Athletes love this thing. It's very space conscious.
I think I've seen this on Instagram.
Yeah, the Hot Box. So he's a friend of mine. And he did it for himself during the pandemic, made it for himself. And his wife is like, hey, this is really cool. You should, like, we should do something with this. And then he invented the Hot Box. Now he makes them. I think he did like maybe a couple hundred this last year in sales, like hundreds of them.
That's cool.
And they're very craft, you know, cedar wood, I believe, charred wood on it, like very craftsmanship, you know, high quality. Like the metal works in it is really cool. And it's called the Hot Box and they're up and coming. But like he was, you know, an everyday folk, just like you and I, doing their own thing. And then he's like, you know what? I'm going to do this. And now he runs a company. Now he's in charge of employees and, you know, sales and marketing and things like that beyond what he thought he would be doing. And now they're doing some cool stuff.
When I was growing up, hot boxing was way different than that.
Yeah.
Well, you can still hot box in the hot box.
Well, that's the, in this case,
it's always the mobile, isn't is it? Important. I mean, historically, I guess you can hot box anything that's, doesn't have to be moving, I guess. That's always what we thought about it.
Well, awesome, guys. It's been fun having you on the show. I feel like it's just, it's always good talking to you guys. There's no direction. It's like a Seinfeld episode. There's no rhyme or reason to the conversation.
It's a podcast about nothing.
It's a podcast about nothing, but that's sometimes are the best ones, right? So I think it's a rare opportunity for me because I do podcasts, but normally, you know, it's with somebody who's got to talk about the topic, you know, the topic, and that's what you talk about with you guys. I feel like it's, I mean, it's because we're all doing podcasts, and I think it's all just sort of a nice break in a way, just chat. But yeah, you guys are awesome. So
thank you, Joe.
Same to you, man. Appreciate it.
A fun one, yeah. If you ever
always
need a
talking to you.
Likewise, yeah. If you ever need a another rambling guest on Changelog, let me know. I'm happy to join whenever.
Awesome.
So, yeah, cool. All right. Anything as you close out? Anything you want to announce? Anything you guys got going on? That's you're stoked about.
Thehotboxsauna.com.
This entire
that's your laser tag studio. I'm just kidding. That's a name you're saving up.
Veteran owned as well. I love veterans. I'm
cool.
Veteran myself.
Nice.
Now I think listen to more podcasts, make more podcasts, build your network, show up and give, don't take.
Yeah.
You know, be there for the relationships, not for the transactions. Obviously, you desire greatness and good things in your life, but don't just come for those things. Come to show up and serve people. I think you'll gain much value in your life to just showing up and helping people. You're stuck somewhere in life and you got nowhere to go for yourself, just go volunteer somewhere. Find somewhere to help. Find somewhere to serve and show up. And I think you'll find more reward in that than really anything. And you might find your next best friend and the next connection you need to your next big thing. And that's happened to me in my life every single time. My break in life, I don't know if I've ever shared this, and this is probably not something you want to share at the end, but my break, I think, my big break in life happened randomly at a bar in Orlando, Florida, because I was there supporting a friend of mine who was a terrible DJ, and it was his first time ever DJing to a crowd, which was basically the early DJ, which nobody shows up for. They're not there for that person. They met somebody who was there also like me to support their friend, and this is their new friend. And I'm this person that is naturally just going to go up and introduce myself because that's who I am. If you're a friend of my friend, you're a friend of mine is what I said to him. His name is Sean Hughes. He worked for a company called Muzak. And he was building a sales team. And I was working at Fridays, TGI Fridays. Not the best job in the world if you're trying to like accomplish something in life. I had plans to go to Full Sail and get into audio production and film and stuff like that. Sure. But I went up to him and I said, dude, if you're a friend of mine or a friend of my friend, you're a friend of mine. How you doing? And he's like, I like your attitude. He invited me in to interview for the job, and I got the job.
Hell yeah. Plus, you don't have to wear all that flair anymore, too.
Well,
nice, so.
Not a TGI, not that. So this was a front row Fridays. It was different than the other Fridays.
Oh, okay.
This is more like really big on the gaming. It had multiple levels. It was super cool.
That's cool.
I made good money there, but like it was not the job I was trying to like.
It's not a job of the future, man. Yeah, I mean, right. To be real.
Yeah. And I got this break. I was an inside salesperson. I learned about LAPD, not the Los Angeles Police Department, but leads, appointments, deals, proposals. That's still how I do in my life, you know, sales, except I do all those jobs now versus somebody getting to do some of the LE for me and I do the DP. But yeah, that's how it worked out. So show up and help.
Show up and help.
You meet somebody that's going to change your life.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We'll see you soon. All right. Take care. Thanks, take care. Bye-bye.